The Guardian.
This is Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and I'm at the 64th Cannes Film Festival. On the show this week, defending the indefensible, a giant of European cinema, actor Stellan Skarsgård wades into the festival's biggest controversy as he exclusively explains the mind and the films of his friend Lars von Trier to Film Weekly. Bringing laughter and light to the proceedings, I meet one of the year's breakout stars, French actress Bérénice Bejo, who managed to sweep Cannes off its feet with some fancy footwork in the rapturous black-and-white silent movie The Artist. And anyone for the funniest film ever made about the Talmud? I meet Israeli director Joseph Seder to penetrate his brilliant film Footnote. Guardian critic Zam Brooks and film writer and journalist Agnès Poirier will be joining me to round up the last week of the festival and to take a punt on who may take the big prizes on Sunday night. Yes, it's the sound of cinema. It's a Film Weekly Cannes special.
I am, of course, very much fortuitous. No, not too much, because Israel is a pain in the ass. But still... how can I get out of this sentence?
by another question. Here's your salvation.
I just want to say about the art of the. I'm very much for Speer. I liked. Okay, I'm a Nazi.
That's Danish director Lars von Trier catching himself in a net of his own dark humour. Von Trier's declaration that he was a Nazi, humorously intended or otherwise, created a furore here at Cannes, and in a special meeting of the Cannes Film Festival board, it was announced that von Trier was banned from the festival. His film Melancholia, however, remains in the competition, but now hangs over proceedings like an ominous approaching planet.
The Earth is evil. We don't need to grieve for it. What? Nobody will miss it. But where would Leo grow? All I know is life on Earth is evil.
There may be life somewhere else,
but there isn't.
How do you know?
Because I know things.
Hollywood star Kirsten Dunst as Justine there in a scene from Melancholia. The film is told in two parts, first as a wedding scene in which Justine, the newlywed bride, battles her depression and dysfunctional family. And the second part of the film follows Justine, now fully mired in her own manic depression, with her sister, played by Charlotte Gainsbourg, and her son and husband as they watch the passing of Melancholia, a huge greenish planet hidden behind the sun, but now coming towards Earth at a rapid pace. The film is both cosmic and deeply fatalistic, but undeniably it's visually a tour de force from von Trier. Well, as this festival has proved, an artist is quite often a poor advocate of his own art, so I turn to one of the film's actors, Stellan Skarsgård, who plays the manipulative character Jack, Justine's tyrannical advertising boss in Melancholia. Stellan Skarsgård, welcome to Film Weekly. What a pleasure to have one of Europe's finest actors on the show.
Oh, you flatter, thank you very much.
Yes, but I get you in a good mood. Listen, Stella, today I've got to talk about the world ending and Melancholia a bit, and obviously that the news is filtering through as we're talking. Someone's telling me that Lars von Trier has incurred the wrath of the festival with his comments at the press conference yesterday. You were sitting there next to him. How do you view these controversial comments?
Well, if he would have been a Nazi, it might have been a controversy, but he's not. He was a Jew till he was 33.
But I mean, obviously people say he was joking, but obviously the festival have not found it very funny.
Well, maybe the festival should publicize a list over topics that you can't joke about.
Mm-hmm. So it hasn't kind of changed your view of him. Is it kind of a typical behavior from him?
He can say anything. He can say anything, but when you know also that most of the things he says is full of irony, there's a slight Tourette's in it. He likes to say things that people not necessarily want to hear.
This one I thought maybe started funny and then stopped being funny quite quickly. And it's a bit of a, I think it's a shame for the festival. I wasn't offended As a Jew myself, I wasn't offended on a level of that. I was offended because I just thought he was taking this one a bit too far. It seems to be you can take some things too far. All of his films take things quite far until the end of the world.
Yeah, he got stuck in it. I mean, he lost the point with the joke. So there was no punchline, and he struggled to get out of it, but couldn't, and things just came out of his mouth, and I felt a bit sorry for him there. I think he should next time he jokes about the Holocaust, he should prepare the punchline better.
Yeah,
we'll do a dance number. Mel Brooks gets away with it. Mate, what he lacked was a director to say cut. Really, just.
But he never says cut when he directs, you know. He just rolls and rolls and rolls.
And then you get the final result. Well,
but I think his appearance at the press conference would be much better in the edited version.
That's the beauty of art over life. He hasn't managed to turn you off working with him.
No, I enjoy it very much. It's fantastic working with him.
Tell us a little bit about that method, because certainly the section that you're in the film Melancholia is kind of more classic Lars, I would say. It has that kind of almost a dogma feel to it, that wedding. People have compared it to Festen and Thomas Vinterberg's film. Tell us about the working method, how he did that. Was it improvised? Is it very carefully choreographed?
It's not choreographed at all. What he does is, I mean, you know your lines and you come there, and then it says start. And you don't know where to go or what to do or how to do it. You just do things and react on the other actors. And he runs around with the camera and tries to capture it. It's a very, very loose and delicious way to work. But it also means that the actors can't sort of make performances out of the acting, which means that it becomes much more alive.
Has it changed much? I mean, it's the sixth collaboration now with him. Has it changed much since you were doing Dogville with no set? You know, that dogma stuff was really kind of ascetic and kind of strong. And now there's special effects, there's kind of sets, there's lighting. Has his working method changed?
I mean, the first film when he had changed his way of working, the first five films he did was extremely controlled, up to Europa, or Zentropa as it's called in the States. And he realized after five films that being so controlled, sort of deciding every movement, every attitude of the actors, took away the life from the film. So he regards his first films as very cold, and I agree with him. So he started on Breaking the Waves was the first film where he let the actors loose, and we were allowed to do whatever we wanted. And there was a big sign on the set that said, make mistakes, which is great encouraging for an actor. But the thing is also that the roles are so different. He writes fantastic roles for women and not so good roles for men. So and the lead is always a woman. And I think he was sort of the beginning, his earlier films, he had more the idea that he could hypnotize the women into do something remarkable. And now he realizes more and more that he can let them be very much, and some fantastic things might happen anyway.
It's interesting because you come back to do the stuff in your homeland, and then you do the big Hollywood things. Is it an international career for you? Do you know where you're going next? Or do you work things out still? And do you sort of say, well, I'm going to stay here for a bit and do one for home and then go off and do Thor?
Well, I don't really have a plan for it. I've never planned my career, but I really appreciate that to be able to go and do big Hollywood films and then a small independent film. And by being in those big Hollywood films, I help the financing of those small films. Sometimes I even pay money myself to be in those small films because I want to see them made. You know, and of course in the smaller independent films the directors have more power, they're usually more courageous, and the roles are usually more complicated. So I need that as well.
The meaning of Melancholia, the end of the world, how would you view the end of the world? Where would you want to be when it happened?
Or in bed with someone.
Yeah, preferably not alone. Talking about family...
Coming at the same time as the world explodes. I don't know, it might be fun.
Maybe people could confuse Stellan Skarsgård orgasm with the end of the world. Yeah. I've heard that I've heard they're pretty something.
It would impress a woman, at least.
Did the earth move? Darling, it finished. Stella, just before, I want to talk about, you also worked with your son in this film, your vampire son, Alexander Skarsgård. Amazing that he's having a career as well, and he hasn't even got your accent.
No, he hasn't. His American English is perfect. But, and he filed down his teeth and came over. It was very nice. I have actually three sons that are very successful actors now. Two other, Gustav and Bill, as well. And it's fun working with them because you realize how much alike you think. When you talk about a scene, when you go into a scene, you feel that you're sort of attacking it from the same angle. It's great fun.
You must have been doing something, right? Three sons all want to do a career. Normally people say, well, don't put your sons on the stage. A lot of actors say, well, don't be an actor. It's terrible. They must have looked at you and thought, well, he's having quite a nice time. I want to do what he does.
Probably that's what they thought, because I've never encouraged or discouraged them. It's their lives, and I don't design their lives for them. And from the age of 16, they're on their own.
Well, they're not alone in this film because their dad's there with them. I wonder if that increases the creativity or makes him behave himself a little bit more. I don't know. Maybe all more badly behaved than they are anyway. I don't know.
Well, I'm not going to go into that.
Stellan, it comes across to me. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show once more. Good luck dealing with Lars. The festival say he's persona non grata, so I don't know where you're going to find him.
I don't know what that means because it's never happened in the festival before, and I don't know what pressure the festival is under, but I think it shows a lack of judgment from the festival and at least a lack of spine.
Yeah, they had to make a tough decision, and someone made it, but we can argue the meaning of that and the meaning of the film Melancholia for weeks to come, and yeah, Maybe we'll do it. Stellan, thanks for coming on Film Weekly again.
Thanks, Jason. Good to see you again.
From the end of civilization as we know it to the demise of a golden era in cinema. Silent films gave way to the talkies in the late 1920s, but they retain a special place in our hearts, and it's this love which fuels one of the finest films at this year's Cannes Festival. The Artist is a black and white silent film shot in France and Los Angeles, and it's the work of French director Michel Aznavisius. It tells the story of George Valentine, a Flynn-like idol played by Jean Dujardin, and his affair with the ingenue Pepe Miller, played by Berenice Bejo. Bejo is quite simply a revelation in the role, evoking a whole era of screen goddesses. So I was thrilled to catch up with the glowingly pregnant Berenice Bejo here in Cannes, and I began by asking the festival's newest minted star which actors she'd drawn on for her inspiration.
This movie talks about all the references I have since I'm a little girl. I wanted to be an actress because of the American cinema, and I start looking the actress that I could refer to, and the one I adore and totally fell in love with was Joan Crawford in the 30s. She was totally free, mm-hmm, and crazy and cute and adorable. Her face was a little sweet, you know, mm-hmm, and she changed so much. But I was like, I saw her in every scene of Pepe, and I thought, I need something like that. I need her peps, the way she danced, the way she moved. And then I went to the glamour part. I went to Marlene Dietrich, who's an animal.
Looking at all those goddesses, yes, of the silver screen, how did you have to change the actual way you act? Because Pepe's great, obviously, and we can all do what the French call les grimaces, the mugging.
Yeah.
We can all do that, ooh, the winking, and that kind of thing. But you have to actually create a part. And what's great about the film is that it's not a sketch of 20 minutes. It's actually a film with a narrative and feeling and passion, and Pepe brings that. Initially, yes, the comedy is fine.
Yeah, of course.
But then you develop that, Berenice. So yeah. Where did you realise what the skill of silent acting was?
I talk about Johnny Depp at the photo press. Photo call. He doesn't move. He's here. You know, I have the right to be here. I'm a good actor. You're happy to see me. Okay, take the picture. There's something calm and, you know. And
it's very interesting because many people say that Johnny Depp is a silent movie star, uh-huh, monkey.
Yeah.
So he would have been great in those days.
Yeah, he would. But he, you know, and I had to find that in me. Because French, we work very minimalist, you know. It's a lot of dialogue and it's all in the body, inside, and it's very intellectual. It's great. But I had to find the body. So when you say, the all the moves she does, it was not so easy. I had to, because I didn't want to pose. Mm. I wanted to interpret, you know. I want to be the character. I didn't want to be an image I didn't want to do pantomime. So even when I whistle, you know, I was like trying so much whistle. It's weird, but I was in my house, like, how does she do? And then I felt like all my body has to go for the whistle. And when I kiss Goodman or someone, my kiss has to go all the way of my hands. You know, it's a work that it was very animal. And then...
What about the tap dancing? Because there's one scene where we don't see you, we see your legs.
Oh, that's me.
Are they? Yes, I'm sure no stunt legs needed, dear listener. They are very fine legs. Then we see just them working. I'm sure that's you.
Yeah.
But you obviously, did you know how to dance? Were you a tap dancer before? No. I've always wanted to be a tap dancer.
Me too. So that's why when Michelle wrote that, I was like, great, I'm going to learn. And we did 6 months of rehearsal, and every day I had a dance coach too. And Fabien Ruiz is a French tap dancer. He was one of the fast tap dancer of the world. So he was really, you know, very good. That was one of the biggest challenge. Mm-hmm. You know, that was something I didn't know and I had to learn.
Yeah. Did you, you filmed in LA as well, which is kind of extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't have to, but you did film in LA. So you managed to get some American actors as well. But you also had those old Hollywood locations. And I think the house that Pepe Miller... Wait, is this correct? The house that she gets when she becomes famous is Mary Pickford's house.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you were living in the house of a silent movie star.
Yeah, and the bed where George Valentine wakes up in the middle of the night is her bed. That's the magic of, you know, of the cinema. Sometimes you have those little surprises that makes, you know... But then you're in the work, and then you forget all that.
Of course.
But still, when we arrived and that you're in Hollywood, I was tap dancing every day in my garage in front of the Hollywood sign. And that's, you know, for a French actress, that was really intense.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in the streets of Hollywood. We could see the Charlie Chaplin's studios and the Warner Brothers studios. I mean, it was very, comment on dit, inspiring, you know, for an actor. But then you forget, and then you're in the work, and you just want to give the best of yourself.
But this work, I mean, you're going to be back in Hollywood, let me tell you, because this film has become is the great hit of Cannes. Everyone is falling in love with it, and falling in love with you.
There's still five movies, you know, there's still 15 movies to go.
Sure, but it's a hit, people love it, you know, whether it wins, that I don't know.
I know.
Seems people will fall in love with Bérénice Bejo or with Pepe Miller, it doesn't really matter. This is... Cannes sometimes makes dreams and careers, and I kind of was watching it going, and I've watched you for some time, but I thought, wow, it could happen for you after this, Bérénice. Hollywood and stuff.
You know, I've been working for 15 years, very, some people would say very slowly, because I'm very picky, and I'm ready for whatever happened, and I don't believe anything, I mean, till the moment, you know, I'm on set and I work.
Right.
I'm very honest with that. But I took everything yesterday, and all the applause and all the people who came to me and everything, you know, and I said thank you to everybody. But, you know, we'll see, you know, the movies at Cannes with all these other big directors and actors, and De Niro have seen me, and you know, it's cool. I don't know if you say that in English.
It is cool. That's all I can say.
Really,
but it's a cool film as well. It's a beautiful film. It's a movie that made me kind of very joyous as well. But I think there's more to it than that, because it was a very sad performance. The two of you had a lovely relationship going on through it. Of course, there was a dog as well.
Yeah.
That kind of kept stealing scenes.
Yeah.
How was working with a dog?
Well, the dog, it's a long story. He had a better part at the beginning of the story. I read the first script and he had a bigger part. I was like, okay, so it's George Valentine and the dog and my part is so small. And Michelle was like, no, it's okay. But the dog is the thing that takes you to the Walt Disney thing, you know, that's, you can't take your child to see this movie. It's the naive part of the movie that we really need. You know, this movie for me is like when your mom sits down and said, okay, once upon a time there was, and you know, and that's the feeling I have with this movie.
No, it's a little fairy tale on screen and I think off screen as well, because if you are now, you're going to be the baby.
Yes,
you have to give it a silent movie or a name.
He will.
It's a he. We know it's a he, by Felicitas. It's a silent era movie. And, of course, everyone is going to be dressed, as I swear, 20s.
Yeah, I can't dress like Pepe Miller anymore right now, but next year I will.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's going to come because there's...
It's cool, aren't
it? It's a great new look.
Yeah,
plush hats. Did you keep any of the costumes?
Yeah, they gave me all the costumes, actually.
Really?
Yeah, all the costumes that were made on me. Then, yeah.
Because they can only fit you.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I can't wait to see you in some of those costumes again. Because there's the Great Gatsby they're making as well. And so I think there's going to be a trend for 20 stuff.
Oh.
And now I see that, yeah, I think it's going to be the hot new look.
Okay.
But congratulations. Good. Until then, if we don't see you, when the film comes out in Britain, we'll see you maybe, baby and all, I don't know, depending on the time. But have a good pregnancy and have a very good journey with this film, because I think it's absolutely delightful and charming. And so are you, Bernie Spéjol. Merci beaucoup.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you for those words. Very kind.
We go from noir et blanc to plage et planque. Yes, I'm here on the Moët beach, sipping a glass of champagne. Very nice it is too, on the Croisette. And joining me to raise a toast, or cock a snoot at the festival so far, is Guardian critic Zan Brooks and film writer Agnès Barrier. Welcome to you both. Bienvenue, Agnès. Thanks so much for joining us. I think 2 years ago we managed to have this A-team together, so it's really nice to be back together. Zan, has Cannes been a vintage festival this year?
I think it has. There's been a few films that have been a bit of a letdown, but that's always the way, and it's certainly provided great talking points, both on screen and, as we're finding out, off screen as well, which I guess is what it's there to do. You know, the Terrence Malick film, for instance, everyone was talking about. The Lars von Trier film, everyone was talking about. It's a proper crucible of drama down on the Croisette, I think.
In sort of true Cannes style, if you can't be good, at least be interesting. And I think all the films have done that this year. Last year, I was very down on the festival. I thought it was very sort of wet and soggy. This one, even from the very first film, the opening night, it was sort of a return, almost the band phrase, return to form for Woody Allen, Midnight in Paris. It's been good from the get-go, hasn't it, Agnès?
It's been very good. I mean, we tend to be extremely harsh with Cannes because we expect the best. And so therefore, you know, we want masterpieces, upon masterpieces. And that's why last year, oh my God, it wasn't as good as the one before. But the one before was extraordinary. So this year, yes. I mean, all the films I've seen, I've been extremely either interesting or very good or set everyone, you know, talking about power, politics, sex, or, you know, rape.
This is a French person's got to throw it away. They've been obsessed with that down at Cannes. But we'll come back a bit more to power, politics and rape, maybe anti-Semitism as well. We can throw a bit of that in a little bit later, I guess. But Zan and I, let's start with the film that you mentioned that has got everyone talking. And I think in a very interesting way, it's Terrence Malick's Tree of Life. Terrence Malick, the great auteur that Cannes have been pursuing for many years. They gave him a prize for Days of Heaven back in 1978, but they've been looking for him ever since. And in some ways, I feel after watching Tree of Life, I'm still looking for him.
Yeah, but the looking for Terrence Malick is all that it's about, isn't it? I mean, he was here, he was around, but he didn't do the press conference, which possibly is a little bit insulting to Cannes. If it's an auteurs festival and you don't actually show up to discuss your film, he didn't go on the red carpet, but I think his wife and daughter were on the red carpet. So he's been hiding out here. This is a film, famously, was supposed to be here a year ago, and there was always the danger that it wasn't going to live up to the hype, that we were building it up too much. And for my money, it surpassed it. I thought it was absolutely extraordinary.
Sort of eluded me, Zan. Tell me about the meat of the story and the sort of base beginnings of vague plot that then he starts as his journey of exploration into the meaning of all things.
Well, I suppose it starts with a quote from the Book of Job, which I guess is the touchstone. I almost thought it was more the Book of Genesis, but I'm not really sure about my Bible. And it takes the Book of Genesis down small town Main Street in Texas, specifically to an everyday family where Brad Pitt is the father. And we know from very early on that one of the sons is going to die. It's never actually specified how he dies at the age of 19. The older son, now grown, is played by Sean Penn. And it's a sort of collage of memory and an inquiry into the universe. This is making it sound horribly, horribly pretentious.
It sounds like an afternoon at Deepak Chopra's spa hotel.
If Deepak Chopra could put together images like Terrence Malick and edit those images to make it flow like Malick does, then I'd be down the spa hotel every single night of the week.
Sam, this is a film that to me, reaches for big questions. It does, and I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but the sort of final answer seems to be a beach where everyone wears white trousers and walks along and paddling in the sort of retreating waves. Is that your view of the afterlife?
That's my view of Cannes. That's where we are now. So it spoke to me very much in the moment.
Actually, when I was in the film, and I think you have to be in the film to enjoy it, when you get out of the film and all the cynicism and all the hubbub kind of affects you, then your actual disbelief is suspended and is burst. And I think that's the problem. I like the film less and less the more I get busy doing something else. Actually, when I surrendered to the film, I was actually really, really was taken by it and kind of entranced by it as well. A sublime film, I suppose, but you have to be in that moment. Like Wordsworth in front of a tree, it works, but not when you're doing the gardening. Terrence Malick's Tree of Life, nevertheless, is a front runner for the Palme d'Or, I should think. A Tree of Life and a Palme d'Or seem to go together very well. That's the spirituality. There has been quite a bit of politics intruding on Cannes this year, not least in the real life form of the scandal of DSK, which the French media have been astounded by, so much so that they wiped Cannes off the front pages and the TV screens to go to rolling coverage of the Dominic Strauss Cannes episode. Agnès Barrier, who covers politics for Le Guardian, has found her Cannes interrupted rudely by this scandal.
Yeah, my life stopped on Sunday morning just after the screening of The Artist, which I loved, and then I went into a bunker. Yeah, I was somewhere in New York with DSK, at least in telepathy, and I've only emerged yesterday to see the Conquest, which is a film about Nicolas Sarkozy, whose path to re-election is now cleared miraculously. So it was extremely strange having to comment on DSK from the Croisette, because you don't know. I mean, reality beats Hollywood. You know, who needs Cannes when you have DSK in a suite in Midtown New York, and we don't know what's happened in that room.
The two French political films, that La Conquête that you mentioned there, and also the competition film Pâté or Pater, which starred Alain Cavalier, an 80-year-old French film director, and French film star Vincent Landon, in a sort of father and son two-hander experimental film. They both get to the heart of French politics, or they did until the DSK scandal queered the pitch a bit.
I think it's a wonderful diptych, you know, to have first Pater by Alain Cavalier, who was, we might remember, Thérèse, his wonderful film, which was in Cannes in 1986. Pater is a film in the film, and it might, I'm sure it can appear as unbearably French and Parisian to many, but I really enjoyed it because it's a reflection on power, men, politics. Alain Cavalier plays himself in the film. Vincent Landon plays himself, a French actor, but of course, they also there's another film in the film, which is Alain Cavalier is the French president, and Vincent Landon plays his prime minister, and they have this wonderful idea to cap incomes. You know, there should be no difference. There should be a difference of 1 to 10, not more, between the lowest income and the highest income. That's quite a revolutionary idea, perhaps one that would save the world actually today. And then the day after, we have The Conquest.
Yeah. Now this was a film that before the festival had perhaps the most controversy or the most news, but going, there was a film, it was going to be about Nicolas Sarkozy, it was going to get to the heart of French politics and how it worked, it was going to be a satirical in-the-loop style look at French politics, something the French have never done, despite the fact they have a spitting image show. In the end, it seemed to me it was in the manner of one of Stephen Frears' films, like The Queen, or his TV movies, The Deal, in which we had real actors playing real-life people. We had a real Sarkozy, played by Denis Poliadis, and we had a brilliant, I think, Jacques Chirac, played by Bernard Lecoq.
Yes, the problem again is the publicity, you know, before the film. One should never know anything about a film before seeing it. And it was supposed to be so brave, so daring, so audacious. It had never been done before. What we have, it's not a film, it's a best-of. Best-of of Nicolas Sarkozy and Jacques Chirac's, you know, best lines between 2002 and 2007. Of course, we've got tremendous performances from Denis Podalydès as Sarkozy and Bernard Lecoq as Chirac. But after the jubilation, you know, of the first few images, when those actors managed to mimic so perfectly these two historical characters in, you know, French politics, then it falls flat because it's not a film. I mean, give me Il Divo by Sorrentino, you know, anytime. Give me Marco Bellocchio's Vincere about Mussolini. I mean, this is cinema. There is breath. There is scope. Despite the fact that the actually used the music composer of Federico Fellini, Nicola Piovani. It never takes off.
As always with these scathing portraits of political figures, I came out actually liking him a lot more after the film than I did going into it. That can't be right.
Well, that's the problem, especially now that we have nobody against him, you know.
Zan, another problem of the Cannes Film Festival was Lars von Trier. How do we deal with him? We've talked to Stellan Skarsgård about that. And I'd like to leave away the kind of extraneous bit, because Lars may have been banned from the festival, but the film obtained, the film remained, the film was still in competition. Melancholia, did it leave you with that sinking feeling?
Well, the great irony about Melancholia is that it's a film about the end of the world and about the apocalypse. And yet it turns out that the apocalypse played out at the press conference afterwards, that we watched the end of the world and thought, you know, that's all right. But then Lars saved his fireworks for later. I think that there was a sense that he could not top or undercut Antichrist, which came here 2 years ago and was famously booed, and everybody accused him of misogyny and bad taste and you know, dedicating the film to Andrei Tarkovsky, which is the worst crime of all. And this is a very different kind of film. It's much more, well, melancholic, I guess. It's at a much lower register. The thing I always felt about Antichrist is it almost felt like the first film that had ever been made, that it was this kind of raw, crude, screaming piece of work. And this is sort of deliberately knackered and exhausted and winding down. That's great, but it makes for a slightly more gentle, perhaps less obviously impressive kind of journey. But I did like it, and I do think he's brilliant. This wasn't one of his best.
Do you think it was depressing, spending all that time in the company of a manic depressive? Even though it was Kirsten Dunst, a very beautiful manic depressive, but I found it dragged me down into sort of a boredom. That actually, strangely enough, that may be what it wants to be. How do you make a film about boredom without being boring? How do you make a film about depression without being depressing? I think you had to go on those journeys. That said, there are beautiful images in it. And I kind of think that he spent so long as a dogma kind of guy. You think, my God, you've done beautiful photographic kind of work, and you think, why don't you spend all that time with those kind of non-lit stuff? It was you were wasting your great visual artistry, I think, in hiding it under a dogma bushel.
Yeah, but isn't it the case that it's like sort of fasting and then gorging, isn't it? That he didn't do that for so long, so now he's really making amends. And this opens sort of with a superb 10-minute opening sequence of tableaus set to Wagner's prelude to Tristan and Isolde. It's astonishing. As to the boredom thing, I wasn't ever bored by it. And I thought that Kirsten Dunst gives a really impressive performance as this sort of damaged, brittle, brilliant person who sees the world as evil and is clearly intended by Lars von Trier to be Lars von Trier.
Yeah, she cheers up as the world ends as well, which is all very nice. Now, the world may not end, but the festival, alas, will have to come to a close, and on Sunday night they will give out the prizes. So I'm going to ask you guys, from what you've seen so far and from what you can divine, on a possible punt. So, Zan, what do you think of the two front runners for the Palme d'Or?
I think so far the two front runners are Aki Kaurismäki's Le Havre and Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life. I have to sort of say that this isn't my thought. This is Leslie Felperin, who writes for Variety, was saying that The Tree of Life will either get the Palme d'Or or it will get nothing. That it's such a huge film that you've either got to say, yeah, just take the main prize and go, or it's almost an insult to give it the jury prize.
Would you be happy with Aki Kaurismäki winning for his first French film? I've got to tell you, I've never enjoyed Kaurismäki. I enjoyed this slightly more because it was in French and Jean-Pierre Daroussin is in it. But really, I found it quirky. I find his style overcomes the heart of quite a good story here about a little immigrant boy trying to get his way out of Le Havre, being helped by an old French shoe shiner. I mean, it sounds even twee as I remember it. It's making me feel a bit ugh.
I agree. It wasn't actually one of my favourites at all. It's just one of the best reviewed films. I thought that The Artist was way better. And I thought the Dardenne Brothers film was possibly the best one that they've done. It's the one that I've kind of warmed to the most. But my hopes are with The Tree of Life.
So I'm going to ask you, for not the who you think is going to win the Palme d'Or, Zan, but who you want to win the Palme d'Or, what your favourite film's been?
My favourite film is The Tree of Life, and my second favourite, I think, is probably The Artist.
At the moment, The Artist is, for me, winning it, just in terms of the... I think it would be the fluffiest and lightest of Palme d'Or winners ever. I looked down the list of Palme d'Or winners all the way back to the, you know, to the pre-war, and I can't see one that's as kind of charming or kind of effervescent as The Artist, but maybe it's time to do it.
I think it would be quite audacious to give it to a silent film.
What do you think the best director will be, Zan? I mean, you can't give it all to Terrence Malick, so I'm asking you to share it out. I'm giving you what Robert De Niro is giving to his jury, the task of kind of mixing it up.
Well, I still have hopes for two people who haven't actually even screened yet. Nicholas Winding Refn, who's here in competition with Drive, and Paolo Sorrentino, who's a brilliant visual director, as you know, Agnes was mentioning earlier, Il Divo, and he screens here as well soon. So, you know, we're still talking about potential winners at a time when some of the potential winners have not yet arrived.
Generally, we do this show and we record it, and then we go and watch a Michael Haneke movie, and it kind of knocks your head. Go, oh my God, that's the one. Last year, I think we did this show. I went to see Uncle Bunmi, who can record his past lives, and I was like, that's the one. So maybe there's one lurking. For me, I haven't seen a nailed-on Palme d'Or winner yet that you kind of go, yes, that's absolutely what they're after. But then this is a funny jury, so you never quite know. And yes, is there a politics to the Palme d'Or? What does it mean for French cinema when you award the Palme d'Or? What do they have to be careful of?
What do you mean it means for world cinema?
Well, yeah, but the French have a different view. The French have a different view of what that might be.
They have a different view on everything, it seems. You know, this isn't the Nobel Prize of cinema, and also the jury. I mean, you know, there's one French person there, but it's a case of, you know, universal agreement. And remember, very often it's not their first choice that gets the Palme d'Or, it's often the second or the third, because, you know, often films have, you know, two strong camps, is that what you mm-hmm. say? Two strong camps against each other, and then, you know, a third winner emerges. So, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, my tip for the one that if the juries are split, like, I hate the Tree of Life, I love the Tree of Life, I think there's one person that could kind of slide between the cracks and just present himself, da-da, with a Palme d'Or, and I wouldn't mind if he won it, is Pedro Almodovar with his film, The Skin I Lived In.
I really like The Skin I Lived In. This is a sort of macabre, gothic melodrama that reminded me of Georges Franju's Eyes Without a Face, and it's Antonio Banderas making his first film with Almodovar in 20 years, playing a demented plastic surgeon. It's one of those films where you find your sympathies penduluming all the way through. So at first you're kind of with Banderas, and then you're with his victim. And it's about the nature of identity as well, and how that is completely up for grabs.
It's about everything, this film. It's about sex, it's about control, it's about power, it's about skin that you live in, it's about the gender, it's about farce, it's about melodrama, it's about cinema, of course, as his films always are of late. I found it thoroughly enjoyable. I found it sort of, for a film about skin, I found it had a sort of skin that I didn't quite penetrate emotionally. It hasn't quite got the poise of Volver or Talk to Her or All About My Mother. But I do think it was a very good Almodovar. It wouldn't surprise me. Well, Zan, you say how nice it was to see Antonio Banderas back for Almodovar, and it really was. What a fine actor he really is. And I think he's much better in Spanish than he is in English. It was lovely to have him back. So welcome back, Antonio Banderas. Also welcome back, Zan Brooks and Agnès Poirier, to this A-team of film criticism. Well, merci beaucoup, Agnès. Thanks very much, Zan. For the best coverage of the festival, go to guardian.co.uk/film.
אם אתם יכולים קצת להצטופף, עוד טיפה בבקשה, ורק אם אתם רוצים אפשר לחייך.
Over the last decade or so, Cannes has paid great attention to Israeli cinema, and Israeli cinema in turn has repaid in kind with a new generation of filmmakers and films that have dealt with highly complex stories, films such as Amos Gitai's Kippur and Ari Folman's Waltz with Bashir. It's in this context that the festival welcomed Israeli director Joseph Sidar, best known for his terrific war drama Beaufort. But here, Sidar takes a completely different turn, with Footnote, replacing pyrotechnics with pedantry in a comic tale of father and son Talmud scholars and the family broigus that ensues when one of them is given a prestigious award. I had coffee with Joseph Sidar to flesh out this comically profound tale. But first, I began by asking if Sidar's own experience of being nominated for an Oscar with Beaufort in 2007 and losing out to the film The Counterfeiters, an Austrian concentration camp drama, had worked its way in to Footnote.
Some of that experience inspired the current film. An investigation into the idea of why recognition is so important, and why we're embarrassed to admit that it's important. And is there meaning behind all these awards, mm-hmm. or is it at the end just an empty event that leaves you wondering why you put in so much hope and energy into it? These are all things that I can't answer, but I know that they're relevant to my life, and the film I've worked on gave me a chance to touch some of these questions.
Mm-hmm. It is about research and, I suppose, sticking to a script in a way, but it's also how you deviate from a script. What was the genesis of your script, and how did you work on it with your actors? Because there's a lot in your film that does go, you know, there's chapter headings, there's different kind of tonal shifts within there, and I think that's kind of what's disorienting about your movie, but it's also what's charming about it.
One of the frustrations I had in my previous films, they were all really formal in their structure. They had a beginning and they had an end, and in the middle, the events had to unfold in some kind of logical order. And I always felt that there's so much more information, layers, thoughts about the characters of the story, that if I only had a way to deliver, the film would be richer. And then as I was working on this film, when you look at academic textbooks, especially books that deal with Talmud, where the writing is sparse, and you can sense that the text has a lot of respect to truth, and therefore it's a little boring because, you know, everyone's afraid of making a mistake. But then in the footnotes, these scholars really go wild. They gossip, they joke around, they say things that maybe aren't verifiable. Everything that you know isn't dignified enough to be in the actual text finds its way into the footnote, and that's kind of how I treated this film. It is a footnote. It's and the film has footnotes within the story, and it was a way for me just to feel flexible and free to use any style, any device, and anything I thought the audience would benefit in understanding the story, I put in the film. And it's great. There's something really liberating about that freedom.
Yeah. The style with which you approach it, I don't know if I was no expert in Talmud. In fact, it got me thinking, what is it? What is the Talmud? Can I buy the Talmud? Can you go out and get a Talmud? How do you know so much about Talmud? Or did you know anything about Talmud?
My education introduced the Talmud from a religious point of view. I grew up in religious schools.
You did?
But that's a very different Talmud than the kind of Talmud that these scholars are working with. They look at it from an academic, very skeptical point of view. It's almost sacrilegious. And that's how I treat the Talmud now. It's an unbelievably rich and vast cultural document. And I even think I've heard serious people say that it's the most impressive text created in human history, and there's an argument for that. It really is. It's a chronicle of dialogues over 500 years or so that go into every single area of life, and at the premise or the basic core of the Talmud is the idea of argument. That when two people argue, or when more people argue about an idea, the idea is crystallized, and that seems to lend itself beautifully to a dramatic structure. Mm-hmm. You know, argument is interesting because any conflict is interesting, but it also helps you understand who you are and what the argument is about. And in that sense, the film really not only is about the Talmud, it's Talmudic in its structure.
Yeah, and it grows, the Talmud. Am I right that the Talmud's never finished because the Mishnah, which is around the outside, kind of adds to it like a tree, I suppose?
Well, that I think that's one of the big debates between orthodoxy or conservative thinkers who claim that, you know, the Talmud is over. It's sealed, and what was is sacred, and anything new is a threat. And the progressive thinkers who always hope that things develop and remain relevant and are modernized. I think that's also one of the gaps between the father and the son here. The father is someone who's afraid of the new. The son is someone who really is afraid of the old.
So can I buy the Talmud? Is there one for sale? Do you get one?
You know, the printed version of the Talmud, yes, it is for sale. You can buy it. It's online.
Is it big? How big is it?
Yeah, it's 20-something volumes. And that's just the basic text. And all the commentaries make it into really a library of over 100,000 books.
Right.
But what these scholars are working on are the manuscripts, the handwritten manuscripts of the Talmud, which was passed on for many years orally and then written down at a certain point but copied over by hand until they were printed and then they were sealed in the printed version. So these scholars are looking at these manuscripts. Some of them, you know, one of the tragic things about Jewish literature is unlike other cultures' literature, it was very hard to save these texts. You know, Jewish books were burnt throughout history. There are no archives for Jewish culture that go back 1,000 or 2,000 years. So they have to look for these manuscripts. Some manuscripts are found in ancient furniture, in the bindings of books. It's they're a combination of detectives, archaeologists, and philologists.
Yeah.
So if you want to see a handwritten version of the Talmud in the UK, you'd have to go to the Oxford University, which has one of the best libraries in the world.
Yeah, it's in the Ashmolean, I think. Is that right?
Right. Yeah.
The fact is that you know, normally when there's a film that's about a book, they kind of inspire sales in the book. And I'm just wondering if your film is going to kind of make the Talmud another bestseller.
You know, I don't think so, but maybe the opposite is true. You know, people who have spent time with the Talmud, and the Talmud is a way of life, who usually don't go to see movies, maybe they'll go see this one.
Yes, exactly. Well, there you go. There's a few more bums on seats, right. Quite big bums. It's a film that's about religion in some ways, but it very rarely mentions God. There's no one praying in your film at all.
Well, thank you for noticing that, because a few of my films have been about religious people, but never about religion. It's sacrilegious because the Talmud is sacred to people who believe that it's a divine text. But for people who research it for its mistakes, of course, the word divine is anti-research. And they found many, many mistakes. Some of them are really funny. Because when you copy a text over and over again, things are omitted or changed. And you can learn a lot by all these mistakes. But primarily what you get is that the text that is considered sacred is really a collection of many, many sources and many, many errors, typos, that have now gone to have all this really serious meaning, but the source is just a mistake. Mm-hmm. And in the center of this film is a mistake that also has tremendous, tremendous meaning. So somehow this kind of skepticism towards any text is true for Talmud research, but it's also a key to understanding this film.
You said you were brought up yourself from a religious background. Your parents are religious. Is your father still alive, yourself?
My parents, thank God, are alive. And I grew up in an observant Orthodox home.
Mm-hmm. So the text was divine for you in some way, from your parents handing it down, text was divine.
Well, I'll counter that, yes. I mean, I can't argue with that, but it was balanced with a very high value that I was brought up with, and that is humor. So, you know, which is absolutely necessary for any religion. Sometimes religion is scary and violent, and it's very clear to me that the absence of humor is what makes religion a threat to the world. But the right balance between considering certain things sacred and other things completely hilariously funny is a good balance.
Yeah, it's a very good. Yeah, that's how we should approach things. I think with cinema as well, because here we're in Cannes, and they kind of call the Théâtre Lumière the great temple of cinema. And sometimes they could do with a giggle in there. It seems to me, especially at this stage of the festival, your film provided that. I just wondered when I asked if text would divide. Does your family now think that what you do, cinema, is a worthy pursuit for a nice Jewish boy?
I think my parents are very proud of me. And they've encouraged me. It's not my. I come from a house that is progressive and curious and skeptical, and it's not a house that limited my horizons at all.
And your father has seen this film?
My parents were at the screening. My father is a scientist, and before they walked in, they didn't know about the plot. I mean, they had a general idea, but they didn't see the film or anything. And you know, some of the things in the film might feel a bit familiar to them. So I reminded them that how important humor was in our house. And
so now, Dad, before you see this film, remember how you always told me to be joking.
So this is when, you know, you have to pull that humor out of wherever you're hiding it. And they were emotional and excited at the end when everyone stood up at the end of the screening. I don't know, we were all shaking. It was, you know, I think it, as a father, I can say, I imagine it's nice to see your child have this kind of satisfaction. Sure. But as a son, looking at my parents, I don't know, it's just a form of communication with them. You know, make this film that deals with the relationship between parents and children, and then we're here in Cannes, 2,000 people are standing and clapping to something that's really a personal message between my father and I. It's crazy.
Joseph Cedar, I can think of no better note on which to end. Footnote, congratulations, Mazel Tov, on that, and the best of luck when Sunday comes.
Thank you very much.
I'm sure Footnote will be getting a release in the UK. It's one of my favourite films of this 64th Cannes Film Festival. Indeed, when any film that Film Weekly champions gets a UK release, we'll be the first to bring you the news. A huge thanks to all of my guests on this special show, to Stellan Skarsgård, Berenice Bejo and Joseph Cedar. And that is all we have for you from the 64th Cannes Film Festival. Next week, we'll be out of the sand and back on home turf, digesting the top prize winners and seeing if the jurors here agree with us. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, from Cannes, we say au revoir et à bientôt.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.